climax. I know, I said, careful not to be too cooperative, but it's probably easier if we just let them get on with it. She stepped aside.
Just don't touch anything. Anything at all.
His squad filed into the room. They began yanking open doors and looking behind screens. No Adrian anywhere. I caught Mrs. Enderby's eye. What the hell have they done with him? She winked at me.
What's through there?
Said their leader, pointing through an open archway. She said in surprise,
Our fitting room, of course. You can't go in there.
He set off.
No, she said. Wait!
He ignored her. I waggled my eyebrows at her and followed him in. A pleasant scene met my eyes. Late afternoon sun was slanting in through the windows. A number of dummies against the wall showed a range of Tudor costumes, both male and female. In pride of place, however, was a stunning court dress for the upcoming TV series on Elizabeth I from Cutter Cavendish Productions. Mr. Cutter's latest venture into the world of historical fiction involved an apparently 30-year-old virgin queen shagging the Earl of Essex bandy before sallying forth in The Golden Hind to lay into the Armada personally. Don't ask. There's history, and then there's Calvin Cutter's history. The dress was gorgeous and huge. The Virgin Queen didn't mess about when it came to her wardrobe, and neither did Calvin Cutter. If we added any more layers, we'd have to put the bloody thing on wheels. The dress was being modelled by a tall figure standing in the middle of the room on a sheet, arms outstretched. They'd obviously reached a tricky point in its complex construction, because a team swarmed over the wide petticoats like ants over Mount Snowdon. The heavily embroidered cloth of gold overskirt was flipped up and covered the model's face. Two more people were fitting the sleeves, and another was crawling on the floor, tacking up the hem. I stared. The model did seem rather tall, and I couldn't think who it could be. We didn't have anyone that tall in wardrobe. Beside me, the officer stiffened.
Well, I said cheerily, nothing to see here.
He didn't reply, walking slowly into the room, circling the figure which, at the same time, and by a strange coincidence, was also rotating, in accordance with instructions from the construction crew, and keeping its face well averted. Shall we go? I said, trying to edge him towards the door.
I don't think so, he said, slowly.
Shit. I looked in dismay at Mrs. Enderby, still slightly dishevelled from crawling about on the floor. The officer caught us staring at each other and drew an unfortunate conclusion.
And through here,
I said, gesturing back towards the archway and hoping that subconsciously he'd move in that direction. He didn't.
Of course he bloody didn't.
All of you, he gestured at Mrs. Enderby's team with his gun. Step back. As one, all those working on the dress stared at Mrs. Enderby. No one moved.
I don't know what you want, young man, she said,
stepping between him and the petticoat-enveloped figure standing on the sheet. The really quite tall figure standing on the sheet. Again. Shit.
I want you all to step back, ladies, before any of you gets hurt.
As he spoke, he moved towards the model, transferred his gun to his other hand, and groped around what I shall refer to as the bosom area. The model uttered a shriek of rage that rang around the room, drew back her arm, and fetched him a ringing slap that nearly lifted him off his feet. Before he could pull himself together, he was enveloped in a maelstrom of outraged femininity, all shouting and waving their arms. Words like pervert, dirty devil, and sex maniac bombarded him from all sides. His cries for assistance did not go unnoticed. The other members of his team burst through the archway, guns raised and ready for anything, although they might not have been ready for the sight that met their eyes. Mrs. Enderby, ably supported by Mrs. Mack and Mrs. Shaw, both of whom had appeared from nowhere, and surely only someone with a mind as evil as mine would suspect they'd been waiting behind the door for this very purpose, were being more than vociferous in their condemnation of nasty, rough soldiers who tried to put their hands down other people's bodices. Technically, the three of them were outnumbered and outgunned by the time police, but that didn't seem to be holding them back in any way, and the time police were giving ground under their onslaught. I remembered these three had fought at the Battersea barricades, stepped back against the wall, and let them get on with it. Chairs and tables were overturned. Tins of pins flew everywhere. The original officer, the cause of all the trouble, staggered and fell backwards over the person who had been tacking up the hem. The remaining policemen pulled out their guns and shouted to the model to put up his hands. There was a great deal of flailing around, and finally the layers of dress were pulled aside, and a dishevelled Rosie Lee emerged, red-faced and furious.
What the fu-?
Half a nanosecond later, she had a gun in her face. Mrs. Enderby surged forwards and knocked it into the air.
Get away from her at once! How dare you attack a member of my staff! And look at the damage to this dress!
She wasn't alone. Mrs. Shaw and Mrs. Mack were on either side of her. The rest of her department surged around like so much indignant pin-bearing flotsam and jetsam, jostling bewildered time police officers who knew something was going on but couldn't quite put their fingers on it if only all these bloody women would stop shrieking at them. Their true quarry, young Adrian, green-smocked like the rest of them, had abandoned his tacking and was kneeling on the floor picking up pins. We'd kept him on his knees to hide his height. Back at Ground Zero, the officer was trying to defend himself from three stout middle-aged women. He was losing on all fronts.
I thought it was him. She was tall.
It wasn't often Rosie Lee was able, legitimately, to attack people, and she was obviously determined to make the most of it.
I'm standing on a stool, you pathetic moron.
Watch your tone, he said sharply and unwisely.
I judged it time to intervene and muddy the issue a little more.
What in the world is going on in here?
I turned to the officer and demanded.
What did you do to her?
Miss Lee burst into noisy tears.
They tried to pull my clothes off.
We didn't. Nothing. I just...
It says no entry on the door for a reason, said Mrs. Enderby. But they couldn't wait to get in here and start tearing her clothes off.
He put his hand down my bodice,
wailed Miss Lee.
I thought she was a boy.
Are you insane? Demanded Mrs. Enderby. Does she look like a boy? Do any of you actually have any idea what a boy looks like? Would you like me to get one in for you so you can familiarise yourself with people who aren't girls? Or are you just a bunch of sick perverts?
They'd pulled themselves together by this time, grouping together in a tight clump, guns bristling. One of them must have had a blaster, because I could hear the whine of it charging up over the sounds of indignant womanhood. I knew I really should intervene before someone got hurt, but at that moment, Dr. Bairstow turned up, standing in the doorway and leaning on his stick. Rosie Lee shut up. Adrian crawled around the back of the dress, well out of sight. Everyone else subsided.
I have been waiting for your report on this afternoon's disgraceful behaviour for some considerable time, Dr. Maxwell. If you thought for one moment that any delay would lessen my annoyance over this unit's reprehensible behaviour, then you were mistaken.
I said, yes, sir. Reviewed what he'd said and amended that to, no, sir. And even then I wasn't sure I'd got it right.
Report.
A considerable number of casualties, sir, the worst being Miss Gray. I spared a minute to hope Cox and Evans had had the sense to hide Elsbeth under a bed somewhere. She is at present undergoing surgery. I do not, as yet, have any details, but Dr. Stone will report as soon as possible.
You misunderstand me, Dr. Maxwell. I was referring to...
He gestured around him.
This?
Sorry, sir, as you can see, the time police are here again. They haven't yet introduced themselves, and I'm sure it probably wasn't intentional bad manners and general ignorance that prevented them from making their presence known and formally requesting permission to carry out a search as detailed in the treaty signed after we kicked their asses at the Battle of St. Mary's. Having given him this promising opening, I stepped back to let him have some fun. Their officer stepped forward.
Dr. Bairstow, we're tracking an illegal pod and our readings show...
Where?
He interrupted.
Let me see these readings.
There was a muttered consultation with his men.
The radiation signature is very faint. As yet, we have nothing conclusive.
Then why are you here?
Our intention is to locate and apprehend...
On what evidence?
There was another consultation and some head shaking. I heard...
Echoes everywhere, sir. All over the building, including the roof. Outside on the grass, outside the hangar, all over. Some new, some old. There are even signatures from our own pods from previous visits.
The officer turned back to Dr. Bairstow.
As at this moment, Dr. Bairstow, it is not possible to...
He got no further.
So, to sum up, you have arrived this afternoon in pursuit of something your own equipment tells you might not be here.
With respect, Dr. Bairstow, this unit has a record of harbouring...
He might as well have spared his breath. I could have told him that.
Perpetrate an unforgivable assault on one of my staff.
Rosie Lee redoubled her sobs. The entire wardrobe department crowded around to comfort her. The officer made a real effort to regain control of the situation.
We are the time police.
Dr. Bairstow looked around at the milling crowd.
I can certainly see that. Tell me, how is the hunt for Clive Ronan progressing?
I can assure you that every member of...
And yet you are not?
I'm sorry?
He said stiffly.
You and your team do not appear to be engaged in what Commander Hay assures me is your primary objective at the moment, the capture of Clive Ronan, though she assures me that she has deployed all her best people to this end. Can I infer from this that you and your unit are not, how can I put this, her best people?
He turned an unlovely crimson.
Different department.
I think that has been apparent to all of us. So, other than having impeded our casualty clearing, stormed our medical centre, compromised the treatment of Miss Grey, turned my unit upside down, sexually assaulted one of my staff, and compelled me to leave my duties in order to quell a riot, what do you think you have achieved this afternoon?
And now his colour was verging on purple.
I... Quite so. Mr. Markham, kindly ensure our guests are signed out, you should probably sign them in first, and then escort them to their pod, if you would be so good. Dr. Maxwell, my office at your earliest convenience.
I said meekly, yes, sir, and watched the time police follow Markham's team from the room. 30 minutes later, I was in Dr. Bairstow's office. He pulled out a bottle and two glasses from his bottom drawer.
Report, Dr. Maxwell.
Everything's fine, sir. Adrian is still concealed in wardrobe. He'll sit quietly in a corner, tacking hems, just in case the TP suddenly reappear, hoping to catch us out. My key surgery has been successful. The bullet has been removed, and she is expected to make a full recovery. Miss Lee has been plied with alcohol and is now feeling comparatively benign, although it might be an idea to keep the time police away from her in future, for their own good.
Any other casualties?
No, sir. Every officer was able to make it back to his pod unaided.
I meant among St. Mary's personnel.
Sir? He sighed.
I believe the history department brought the barn down.
Sorry, sir, I'd forgotten about that.
You had forgotten the demolition of a substantial wooden structure that has stood on this property for some considerable time?
Oh, God, sir, it's not listed, is it?
Wrecking listed buildings leads to all sorts of trouble, trust me.
Fortunately, no. That does not mean, however, that I am accepting its loss with a careless flick of my wrist and a light-hearted laugh.
No, sir, I said, trying to imagine him doing either of those things and failing.
Casualties, Dr. Maxwell?
Quite light, actually, sir, I said, glad to be able to report good news. I don't think Mr. Bashford even lost consciousness.
Are you sure? I distinctly saw Miss Prentice covered in blood and Mr. Cox appeared to have an arm hanging off.
Make-up, sir.
I beg your pardon?
Casualty make-up, sir, for when we have disaster practice.
We have to practice having disasters?
Sorry, I expressed myself badly. I should have said we have casualty makeup for when we familiarise ourselves with the correct procedures to be undertaken should we have a disaster, to add an air of realism to our simulation, sir.
I congratulate you and your people on the realism of this afternoon's disaster.
I beamed. He'd forgotten about the barn. Crisis averted. Thank you.
I thought the collapsed barn was particularly realistic.
Oh, no, he hadn't. We do our best, sir. I looked at him. The current crisis had been resolved. No one had died. There were no bodies buried anywhere. And the barn could be rebuilt. Probably. And annoying the time police always put him in a good mood. There were no deductions from wages for damages incurred forms on his desk, so I took a chance. Tell me, sir, when you first set up St. Mary's all those years ago, all that effort and expense, did you ever think it would be like this? He poured me a glass of something and pushed it across the desk. Dr. Maxwell, I expended a very great deal of money and effort to ensure that St. Mary's ended up exactly like this. I grinned and raised my glass. Good job, sir. He inclined his head, graciously accepting his due. Thank you, Dr. Maxwell.
Chapter 10. Obviously, despite all our best efforts to distract him with chicken shit and exploding barns, the idiot Halcombe found out about Persepolis, and he wanted to be included. And then he found out about the Crown and insisted on being involved in that too. I couldn't decide where he would do least damage and took my problems to Dr. Bairstow. We have to get rid of him, sir, I said. Not just because the Persepolis jump is imminent and the Crown is coming, but now we have Mikey and Adrian, and that could be a problem as well. At the moment, Mikey is camouflaged among the wounded survivors of Professor Rapson's great battering ram catastrophe, but Adrian can't sit sewing hems in the corner of wardrobe forever. No, indeed, he said, sitting back in his chair. Do I understand your efforts to rid St. Mary's of this troublesome priest have proved ineffectual?
I'm afraid so, sir. He has a hide like a rhinoceros.
He said, thoughtfully.
Sir?
Please do not regard this as any sort of learning experience.
Sir?
Come with me, Dr. Maxwell.
There was a hell of a row going on. There often was these days. Halcombe and Clerk were standing face to face, toe to toe. Clerk was flushed and furious.
You ruined the Caernarfon assignment. None of us can ever go back there again. We only ever get one shot at anything, and you ruined it. If you think you're going anywhere near Persepolis, then you're gravely mistaken.
He turned to me.
You put me in charge of the Alexander part of this assignment, and I tell you now, Max, there is no way I'll have this pillock anywhere near my pod, and that's final. If he goes, I don't. Everyone knows he turns and runs at the first sign of trouble, and that was just a small town in Wales. God only knows what damage he could do in a burning palace. I won't have him in my pod.
Nor me, said Atherton, surprisingly given his usual let's all get on together position. The bloke's unreliable.
The bloke's an arsehole, said Sykes from her position of couldn't give a shit. Arsehole being a technical term frequently used in the history department.
Halcombe drew himself up.
I represent the University of Thirsk. May I remind you all that I am here at the instigation of the senior faculty because of St. Mary's inability to function either effectively or efficiently, or even legally. Members of St. Mary's staff stole a valuable artifact belonging to the university, and if I had my way, many of you would be serving a substantial prison sentence.
Well, that's never going to happen, is it? Said Clerk hotly, because you're too busy abandoning people up and down the timeline. If you have your way, there soon won't be any of us left to put in prison.
Swelling with pomposity, Halcombe warmed to his theme.
I have contacted the Chancellor to inform her that the security arrangements here at St. Mary's are in no way adequate for keeping safe such a valuable artifact as the crown of the Empress Matilda, and instructing her to cancel all the arrangements pertaining thereto.
There was a torrent of protest.
Shit. This was getting out of hand.
I went to intervene because sooner or later someone was going to thump the pillock, and however commendable I might find that, we'd be in serious trouble. Just as I was taking a breath to calm everyone down, Dr. Bairstow put his hand on my shoulder.
I'll handle this, Dr. Maxwell.
If you like, sir, but I should point out that Mr. Halcombe really can't be permitted either to go to Persepolis or disrupt our other plans.
Of course not, he said calmly.
Halcombe was attempting to speak again, but his efforts were drawn out by the history department in full flow. Even North was having a go at him. In a dignified and restrained manner, of course,
but I'd once seen her attack Herodotus with a wooden tray and lived in perpetual hope of a repeat performance. She never got the chance. Dr. Bairstow thumped his stick on the floor for silence and got it. Halcombe moved forward to take advantage.
"Ah, Bairstow, I see your control over this rabble has not improved in my absence. With immediate effect, you will..."
Dr. Bairstow regarded him icily.
"All my staff are hand-picked."
"That's quite true, actually," said Markham sunnily. "I've been hand-picked many times. Mugshots, police line-ups, ID parades. People are always pointing at me and shouting, 'That's him!'" I don't think Dr. Bairstow even heard him.
"Mr. Halcombe, you are here because the University of Thirsk has agreed to foot the bill for our recent damage, and we are in their debt. You will, I am sure, remember that on your first, and what I can assure you was your last assignment with St. Mary's, you not only displayed appalling leadership qualities and a complete lack of a comprehension of the role required of you, but you abandoned half of your colleagues to cope as best they could in a potentially dangerous situation. You contravened our number one rule, Mr. Halcombe. You left your people behind. It is perhaps fortunate for you that my staff are far too courteous to indicate the complete contempt in which you are held, to your face, anyway, and so that duty falls to me. Mr. Halcombe, you are held in complete contempt. You do not have, as far as I can see, a single redeeming quality of any kind. There are no circumstances under which anyone, anyone at all, will ever get into a pod with you again, and you will, therefore, understand very clearly that, as far as you are concerned, your participation in this or any of our future assignments will not ever happen. As far as I can see, your sole function here is to observe what is going on around you, draw the wrong conclusions, and report these to a Chancellor who is actively seeking a reason to dismiss you. This frequently happens when one does not have the foresight to attach one's wagon to the correct star. You have no friends either here or at Thirsk, and nor will you ever have. The knives are out, Mr. Halcombe, and my advice to you would be to return to Thirsk with all speed and watch your back. Throughout my time as Director of St. Mary's, I have always endeavoured to employ the best and brightest people in their fields. I am not sure which particular field you occupy, Mr. Halcombe, but I think it is very apparent to everyone that whichever it is, you are very far from being the best and brightest in it. I regret to inform you, therefore, that you have failed to achieve the standards required here at St. Mary's, and I would be obliged if you would, from this moment, consider yourself dismissed from my unit. If you are suffering from a lack of comprehension, or there are other, simpler words I can use to make the situation clearer to you, please do not hesitate to apprise me of them."
Wow. In the silence that followed, you could have heard a slipper-wearing mouse dance the fandango on a feather cushion. Dr. Bairstow turned on his heel, shot Peterson and me a glance which clearly said, "Amateurs," and limped off into wardrobe. The idiot Halcombe remained uncertainly for one moment and then stormed off to his office. Again, the door slammed behind him. Peterson, Markham, and I grinned at each other. He was gone. An hour later, Rosie Lee reported she'd seen Halcombe's car trundling down the drive and out of the gates, and then took advantage of my jubilation by claiming I'd agreed to give her the rest of the day off. I told her to pull the other one. She spent the rest of the afternoon banging files around, and I sat at my desk humming happily, just to get on her nerves. At 4 o'clock, I sent her down to wardrobe to inquire about progress on the Persepolis costumes. I could have gone myself, but I guessed she'd be gone for some time, and I needed the time to think, because I was having second thoughts. Buyer's remorse, I think they call it. Not about Persepolis, the whole burning building thing was what St. Mary's was all about, but about the other end of things. Suppose, just suppose, Ronan did manage to get away with the crown. Just suppose everything went wrong for us, and he actually stole the real crown, and we were left with more than egg on our faces. Yes, the time police would be here, and they'd nail the slippery bastard. I was almost convinced of it. But suppose they didn't? I think, deep down, when I'd pitched my idea to Dr. Bairstow, I'd been convinced he'd say no. But he hadn't. And if this went wrong, if Roland succeeded, there would be no coming back from this. St. Mary's would be finished, and it would be my fault. This doesn't happen very often. Usually I can see quite clearly what should be done, even if I don't want to do it. But it was happening now. I needed to talk to someone. I needed a sober and balanced point of view. And because he had enough on his mind at the moment, someone who wasn't Leon. I tend to stay away from sick bay because every time I go near the place, they find something else wrong with me. I often wonder if Dr. Stone works on commission. I hadn't mentioned this before, but Guthrie was still in there, sitting up and looking better as each day passed. I was astonished at his progress, but he was bringing the same single-minded determination to his recovery and rehabilitation that he brought to every task he undertook. He was walking every day, not a lot, but a little further and for a little longer every day. He certainly wasn't so sick that I would feel guilty about troubling him. But first, I needed to bear gifts. I raced down to the kitchen, braking just in time to avoid colliding with Dottle, who was making her careful way up the stairs with the biggest plate of sandwiches in the history of the world. She jumped a mile, to the detriment of the top layer.
Oh, goodness me, Max, you startled me.
I picked them up and blew on them. They'd be fine. The 5-second rule would apply.
Good God, are you feeding the 5,000, or just Markham?
I'm working late tonight. You look as if you're working until next Tuesday. She smiled shyly.
Hopefully it won't come to that, but I have to do it.
Do what? She glanced nervously over her shoulder again, lowering her voice to a whisper.
I have to do well, now that he's gone. This is my big chance. I have to show people what I can do. Dr. Bairstow, the Chancellor.
She glanced in the direction of Peterson's room, said nothing, but the inference was clear.
Everyone here is so passionate about what they do. I want the chance to be proud of myself and of my job as well. If you were me, you'd do the same.
I would, I said. But make sure you don't overdo it.
I won't. Don't worry. I've made a start by putting some stats together for Thirsk because I think it will give the Chancellor an argument for increasing our funding.
I noticed she'd said our funding, smiled and stepped out of her way. In that case, have at it. She smiled.
I shall. You just wait and see.
She passed on her way, and I shot off, first to the kitchen to pick up a few things, and then on to see Ian Guthrie. Usually half the security section was in there, putting back his recovery by months. Leon, too, spends a lot of time with him. On this occasion, though, Ian was on his own.
What ho?
I said, shouldering my way through the door into the men's ward. I brought you a coffee and some of Mrs. Mack's apple cake.
Oh, excellent. Mrs. Mack's cake will go a long way towards reconciling me to your presence. You talk. I'll enjoy the cake and ignore you.
He looked so much better. His black eye patch gave him the jaunty air of a pirate, and he'd grown a beard, which really suited him. Yes, he'd lost some weight, and his face was very pale, and he still had a cradle over his leg. But compared to the way he'd looked a month ago when he finally came back to us from the time police, he was another person. They'd set him on the road to recovery, they said. The rest was up to him. He was healing well, a tribute to his superior Caledonian stamina, apparently, as opposed to all us non-Caledonian wimps and weaklings. He'd been up and walking a surprisingly short time after having his leg reattached, firstly with a frame and then just a stick. He was very slow still, and he had bad days, but he was recovering. Anyway, today he was miraculously alone, so I plunged straight in with compliments and good wishes.
Oh my God, Ian, you have a badger on your face!
He fingered his beard.
Looks good, doesn't it?
If you're comfortable with that delusion, then who am I to argue?
What do you want, Max? Why are you here?
Major, I have, well, not a problem, but something I need to talk about. He sighed.
This is the price I'm paying for the cake, isn't it?
I had sudden second thoughts. He was still an invalid. I shouldn't be burdening him.
No, the cake is free, and the other thing's not important. How are you feeling? Good, as always.
Yes, that was what he always said. I got up to go.
Sit down, Max. And yes, all right, he wasn't functioning properly, and probably never would again, and his life would never be the same, but he was still Ian Guthrie, and when he spoke in that tone, I did as I was told. I shouldn't be bothering you with this. He finished his slice of cake and started on his coffee. I wish someone would bother me with something. It's my leg that's damaged, not my brain. Good point. I pulled my chair closer. Okay, I have, not a problem, but an issue. I told him everything. My conversation with Captain Ellis, my idea, the plan, everything. And then asked him whether, this time, I'd gone too far. Did the possible favourable outcome outweigh the probable potential for catastrophe? He sipped his coffee, frowning. Have you taken everything into account? Tried to foresee every possible contingency? I thought of all my risk assessments, to say nothing of those dodgy moments at 2:30 in the morning when I lay next to Leon, imagining Ronan wandering out of the building with the crown under his arm and laughing his head off. Yes. And the St. Mary's end of things? That's completely outside your control? Yes, I'm on the Persepolis end. And you have faith in Ellis and his men? I nodded. I do, yes. And Dr. Bairstow? I nodded. And Peterson? I nodded again. In that case, Max, let them all get on with it. They have their function, you have yours. Concentrate on that. Put everything else out of your head and focus on the job in hand. Okay. Tell me you're working closely with Markham on this. I am, I said. And you have complete confidence in him? I do. If I can't have you or Leon, then I'd rather have him than anyone. He hesitated, and then looked around the room as if he didn't want to be overheard. Great, that was two of us at it now. Do me a favour. Of course, I said, thinking he just wanted another slice of cake. Make sure he knows that, will you? I stared at him. I don't understand. He's having problems. Markham? He nodded. What problems? He's the new head of security. Yes, I know. Well, some people are having difficulty accepting that. In what way? He began to brush the crumbs off his covers. Well, the thing is, Max, you and I, and Peterson and Leon, we all just walked into our jobs, didn't we? We were the first. There was never anyone to measure up against. Markham is following me. I'm not big-headed, but comparisons are inevitable, aren't they? He's having some problems, which he's ascribing to not being me. He sees himself as not being tall. He has no army rank to give him the authority he thinks he needs. He's aware of his reputation as a bit of a clown, and so is everyone else. Really? I said, grimly. No, it's nothing bad. No one is defying him or laughing at him, but there's bound to be a bit of settling down to do. But he's been head of security before. He has, but it's always been temporary and short-term. This is permanent. Well, his problem is that he thinks he's not measuring up to me. What he doesn't see is that he doesn't have to. No, I said slowly. I see what you mean. But Dr. Bairstow knows what he's like, none better, and he obviously thinks he's the best man for the job. Exactly. He could have gone outside the unit for my replacement, and he hasn't. The trouble is that everyone here remembers him running into that horse's arse and falling off the stable roof and mucking around in that reindeer suit. They don't always remember him saving Cleopatra from the asp. Or the two of you from Ronan last year. Exactly. And I'm tied here and can't do anything. Leave it to me, I said. I knew I could, he said smugly. Leave the rest of the cake, will you? I got up to go. Where's Elspeth today? He looked mysterious. No, I mean he looked exactly the same as ever. He just assumed a mysterious expression. I inquired if he needed a laxative. He said having me in the same room was all he needed on that score, thank you very much, and to close the door behind me on the way out. Well, that was something to think about, wasn't it? I made my way slowly back to my office, pondering ways and means of putting things right for Markham, of getting him alone somewhere and somehow bringing up the subject without embarrassing him, or myself. As it turned out, I didn't have to, because he was waiting for me in the office when I got back. I peered closely. There was nothing specific, but now that Guthrie had mentioned it, I could see something was troubling him. I kicked myself for not having noticed anything was wrong. He was my friend, and I should have noticed. Time for a tactful chat, on our own. I sat at my desk, picked up a file and said, "Miss Lee, please could you..." And foreseeing I was about to ask her to do some work, she muttered something and disappeared out of the door. Result. "What ho?" I said to Markham. He muttered something and stood staring out of the window. I waited. Something was definitely wrong. Normally, a what ho produces a long lecture on heads of departments having to maintain certain standards, although what standards he's referring to is never really clear. It was obvious he had something on his mind and was having some difficulty getting it off again. With Ian Guthrie's words still ringing in my ears, I thought I'd give him a gentle shove in the right direction. I got up and locked the door, just to give him something else to worry about, and put the kettle on. We waited in silence as the kettle boiled. I handed him his tea and said, "No one cares that you're not Major Guthrie, you know." We stood together staring out of the window. He said, I said gently, "I know, but the only person who thinks that is you." "But, no, you're wrong. Dr. Besto chose you over everyone else. He didn't go outside for Ian's replacement. He chose you." I know you're not Ian Guthrie. No one is. Well, apart from Ian Guthrie, of course. So stop trying to be something you're not. You have your own way of doing things. You have your own identity. You're Markham. You do things the Markham way. But, yes, you've messed around in the past, and you've messed up too. We all have. And, yes, you have some giant shoes to fill, but you're Markham. You're more Markham than anyone I know. Be Markham. It's always worked for you before. Max, I tell you now, with the possible exception of Leon, I'd rather have you at my back than anyone, and I'm not the only one. Actually, you need to embrace your Markhamness. Life is really opening up for you, and I speak for Peterson too. You know, don't you, that if there's anything either of us can do, we'd do it in a heartbeat. Actually, I just came to borrow the Persepolis file. Oh. The room was suddenly very hot. To hide my face, I reached across the desk and thrust it in his direction, too mortified even to look at him. He took it and headed to the door. I continued to stare out of the window in buttock-clenching humiliation. Perhaps in 6 months' time, when the embarrassment began to subside, I'd be able to look at him again. He was flicking through the file, not looking at me. "But that other stuff was pretty good as well." I made an indeterminate noise that could mean anything he wanted it to. There was a bit of a silence. "Thanks, Max." "You're welcome. And don't lose that file." "No, I mean about what you said." "Oh, well, you're welcome." "No, I mean it. Hunter, well, things are a bit, you know, at the moment." I did know. I remembered the panic, the elation, the terror, the overwhelming sense of responsibility, the knowledge it wasn't just the two of us any longer. "How is she?" "Well, early days yet, but she's fine. Better than me, anyway. Everyone's better than me these days."
"You're going to be fine."
He smiled. "What are we talking about at the moment?"
"Anything you want. You have a great future ahead of you. The boss thinks so. Annie and Guthrie, and Peterson, and me."
"Thank you. That means a lot. But sometimes I think..."
"Well, don't," I said sternly. "You know it's not your strong point. Look, it's your section now. You have to do things your way. And your way is...
Are you even listening to me?"
He was looking as if Newton's apple had just landed on his head.
"What? Yes, of course I am. Thanks, Max. You're brilliant." Well, that was true, but I had no idea what he was talking about.
He thumped me on the arm, unlocked the door, and clattered off down the corridor. The memo came round that afternoon, to all heads of departments. Peterson called me up, and we had a good laugh over it. He'd changed the security section's call sign from Hawthorne to Horse's Arse. Chapter 11. We weren't getting things all our own way, however. We might have escaped having the idiot Halcombe foisted upon us, but Thirsk was still muttering about a presence on the jump, which meant Miss Dottle.
"It's a burning city,"
she said faintly, obviously having done her homework. No, it's not, I said, trying to reassure her. Well, not to begin with.
It bloody soon will be after St. Mary's turn up, said Sykes, which didn't help at all.
Actually, said Peterson kindly, I wondered if it would be possible for Miss Dottle to remain here and assist me with the preparations for safe storage of the crown. I could certainly do with an extra pair of hands here. Miss Dottle, I know you're probably itching to be out there with the rest of them, but I really would be grateful.
Yes, of course, she said quickly. I'm happy to help.
Excellent, he said, beaming at her. The more the merrier. I flashed him a grateful glance. Problem solved. I stood up. Right, everyone, the purpose of this assignment is twofold. To catch sight of Alexander and his famous companions as they burn the city of Persepolis, and to rescue anything we possibly can from said conflagration. This assignment will be considerably less structured than our previous jump to rescue the contents of the library at Alexandria, because we don't know what the treasury will contain, or if it will even be possible to get anywhere near it. We are therefore going in without a fixed plan of action, but the capacity to adapt to any situation in which we might find ourselves. Being optimistic, we have already dispatched Mr. Atherton and Professor Rapson to identify a suitable burial site for anything we do manage to lay our hands on. If you could update us, please, Professor.
Thank you, Max. Well, we've sourced appropriate containers and material with which to manufacture pitch, and we've located a safe refuge in which to bury anything we do manage to rescue. The whole thing is very similar to our jaunt to Alexandria. Goodness me, what a long time ago that seems now.
He paused, presumably rummaging through his memories, but since a good number of those would involve Clive Ronan and a homemade flamethrower, I thought it best to move him on. He was pulling up maps and diagrams. I looked at the absorbed faces around me, and I couldn't help remembering our very first search and rescue assignment. I suddenly realized how few of us were still left. People had died there, good people. I remembered Big Dave Murdoch, the gentle giant, and young Jamie Cameron with his shock of dark hair. I don't visit their graves as often as I should, because there's one out there for Madeline Maxwell, and it's not an easy sight to see. And one for Helen Foster, and that's even worse. Evans was lolling back in his chair and banging away on his scratch pad. Without looking at Markham, he said, "Do you want 5-minute position checks?" Silence fell. Everyone looked at Markham, who didn't answer. The silence lengthened almost to the point where it became uncomfortable. People stirred, and still Markham said nothing. I held my breath. The situation needed the very lightest of touches. Evans wasn't a bad lad. None of them were. They just needed to realise this new Markham wasn't the old Markham. Becoming aware of the long silence, Evans looked up and gazed around the table. It took a moment or two, and then the penny dropped. Flushing, he sat up straight and said, "Sorry, do you want 5-minute position checks, sir?" Markham nodded as though nothing had happened. "A good thought. Yes, 5-minute position checks initially. Once the place is on fire, increase to 2 minutes, I think." All the tension went out of the room. People nodded. Just to reinforce the point, I said, "Mr. Markham is the one who will call time on this assignment. We will take our instructions from him. Is that clear to everyone?" People nodded, and the briefing continued without a hitch. "Mr. Dieter, I understand work on TB2 is completed." Dieter nodded. "There are still one or two minor tests to complete, but I guarantee it will be ready on time." He sighed heavily. "Try not to break it." "As if," said Sykes indignantly. And he sighed again. The sigh of a man who has been dealing with the history department for longer than could reasonably be expected. I coughed and continued. "The medical team will have their base in our newly rebuilt TB2, along with Professor Rapson, Dr. Dowson, Miss Lingos and Miss North. Mr. Keller will be there to keep order. Mr. Clerk's team, that's me, Mr. Markham, Mr. Atherton and Mr. Evans, will be in number 8. Our priority is Alexander, obviously, but anyone else we can get as well. Mr. Bashford, Miss Sykes, Mr. Dieter and Mr. Cox, you're in number 6. Make your way to the Treasury and wait for any opportunities that may arise. No one is to take any unnecessary risks. I was wasting my time there. All risks are necessary, according to St. Mary's. I paused, because the next bit was important. From the moment the first fires are lit, Mr. Markham will have overall control of the assignment. I will say this only once. When he says to move out, you will move out. No arguments. We will remain in constant contact, all comms open at all times. No one leaves their group. If anyone is injured, then the entire team returns to their pod. No ifs or buts. Dr. Stone will then assess the situation, and only if he deems it safe for them to continue will that team return to their assignment. I could see Peterson tapping away at his scratch pad. He didn't look very happy. I flashed him a grin of almost manic optimism. He rolled his eyes. We drew our kit. Fire suits and breathing apparatus for those in number 6, and loose Persian robes for everyone else. My chiton was a long, loose linen tunic in a dull browny colour that almost certainly marked me out as a member of the servant class. Over that, I would wind a silk stole in vivid reds and greens that almost certainly marked me out as a member of the servant-owning class. According to Mrs. Enderby, I could move between the two worlds simply by wearing or not wearing the stole. Nor was I wearing the traditional Persian lady's light and elegant footwear, settling instead for sturdy leather shoes. Not what a Persian lady would wear at all, but I would be able to run, climb, and possibly kick, should the situation call for such measures. Outside number 8, Peterson, who'd come down to ensure we were safely off the premises, surveyed my multi-purpose costume. "So, as usual, everyone else will be doing the work, and you'll be... doing what, exactly?" "Oh, you know, wafting about the place, bringing colour and excitement to everyone's day." "For God's sake, take care, Max. I shan't be around to look after you on this one." "I'll be fine," I said. "You just keep an eye on that crown. If anything happens to that, then burning alive at Alexandria will be the least of my problems." We shook hands, and he took himself off to the gantry to watch our departure. I climbed into the pod, where the others were already waiting. Leon was giving the console a final check. He turned as I entered and blinked at my costume. I put my hands on my hips.
"What?"
"Nothing," he said, in that voice that actually means everything. "It's functional," I said defensively.
"It's bright," says the man wearing orange, said Markham unwisely.
Markham had gone for practical in a loose robe which could easily be discarded for the short tunic underneath. Leon turned and looked him up and down.
"Were you on your way to bed?"
"I don't wear anything in bed," said Markham, affronted. Leon grinned.
"Not even a hopeful expression?"
"There's a lot of leg on show," I said. "I'm not sure Persepolis is ready for your nether limbs, and I'm certain it's not historically accurate."
"That's me," said Markham proudly. "Always going outside the box."
"Like a badly house-trained kitten," said Leon. Markham turned to me.
"I tell you what, Max, next time you find a bloke lying under a wall in Constantinople, just bloody well leave him there, will you?"
Leon looked him up and down again.
"Says the man held together by staples."
Checks complete, he picked up his gear and headed for the door. Everyone tactfully looked somewhere else as we shook hands.
"Take care."
"I always do," I said, affronted. Someone somewhere snorted.
"And for God's sake, look after that crown. It'll be a bit of a bugger if we get back only to find someone from the technical department has accidentally built it into number 4.
"What do you mean, accidentally?" muttered Markham. Leon sighed. "Just go, will you?" He smiled for me alone, and then the door closed behind him.
"Right, you lot," I said. "Everyone set? Computer, initiate jump." Jump initiated.
And the world went white. Chapter 12. Persepolis is often described as a city, but it was a city in two parts. The main part, the bit we were concerned with, was the ceremonial area, the complex of official buildings such as palaces, throne rooms, audience halls, civic buildings, the harem, the treasury and so on, all set on a massive artificial terrace some 50 or 60 feet high. Unfortunately, even the most fabulous city in the world needs working bits and pieces to keep it going, and, in contrast to the pomp and splendour of the palaces on the terrace, The surrounding plain was smothered in a disorganized and very motley collection of mostly mud brick, wood and animal hide structures that provided housing and working areas for all the people who actually made the place work. The masons, metalworkers, carpenters, goldsmiths, artists, sculptors, butchers, bakers, leather workers, grooms, recreational ladies, and so on. All the thousands of people necessary to keep the great king in the luxury he obviously felt he deserved. Sadly, Alexander's army had been through the place like a plague of locusts. He'd promised his men the city to loot while keeping the contents of the treasury for himself, and they'd taken full advantage of the opportunity. That was why they followed him, after all. Alexander might dream of conquering the world, but it was the promise of rich pickings that interested his soldiers. The structures nearest the palaces had been razed to the ground. Broken, blackened walls stuck up like jagged teeth. The buildings on the outskirts had fared better, however. Whether this was because the poorer quarter had little to offer in the way of hidden loot, I don't know, but about two-thirds of the city remained untouched, and people, men and women, seemed to be moving around as usual. The presence of Alexander's army, with its tents and campfires encircling the city, did not appear to be impending commercial life in any way. The streets weren't thronged with people, but they certainly weren't empty. People still moved around, a lot of them staggering under heavy loads, because Alexander had commandeered nearly every pack animal in the northern hemisphere to transport his stolen loot to Susa. Soldiers stood at every street corner, most of them leaning against the walls and staring at the women. Their spears leaned with them, so they obviously weren't expecting any trouble. These were professional soldiers who would fight their way from Macedonia to northern India, and there was no showing off in glittering armour or ornate helmets. They were competent-looking men, and in the way of soldiers everywhere, not looking for any trouble unless it came looking for them. Water cisterns stood at regular intervals, presumably for use by the public and their animals. Periodically, slaves would emerge to damp down the streets with water in an unsuccessful attempt to combat the clouds of dust enveloping everything in sight. A surprisingly considerate idea, although it was likely the slaves' priority was to protect the gorgeous palaces and their even more gorgeous occupants from the thick clouds of red dust mixing with the smoke from innumerable small fires. Everyone seemed quite calm. There were no bodies swinging from gallows or heads impaled on spikes. No one was being executed or dragged off to prison. In the less gorgeous part of the city, at least, life seemed to be much as normal. Alexander was, in the main, a benevolent conqueror. As long as you submitted to his rule, behaved yourself and paid your taxes, then life would continue pretty much as before. He'd help himself to any treasure knocking around, install a puppet government, and then push off to conquer someone else. He'd recently returned from an expedition to subdue the mountain tribes, all of whom had surrendered with flattering rapidity, so everyone was in a good mood. We spent an hour getting our bearings, working out where everyone was in relation to everyone else, and just watching Persepolis on life. I'd split the screen, and we had all the cameras going. Number 8 was outside the palace complex on the northwest side, about 400 yards from the great stairway and the Gate of All Nations. Yes, it was the main entrance, and very grand and very public, and I'm sure there would be other gates as well, but the mud brick walls surrounding the palace were over 60 feet high, with regular towers and lookout posts, all heavily manned, and we didn't want to draw attention to ourselves by going out and poking around for more discreet entrances. Just because no one was actually being publicly executed at this exact moment didn't mean that couldn't change in a heartbeat. No, we'd take our chances at the gate. Number 6 was, we hoped, safely lost in the maze of miscellaneous outbuildings between the throne hall of Xerxes and the outside wall. We had spread out as much as we were able to, just in case of trouble. One pod inside the complex, one outside, and one, TB2, down in the town. Hope for the best, plan for the worst, as they say. And no matter where anyone found themselves in difficulty, there should be a pod not too far away. As I said, the much larger and harder to conceal TB2 was parked about a quarter of a mile away, all ready to do duty as safe haven, hospital, treasure repository, tea station, and so forth. Keller and Lingos, under the direction of Professor Rapson, would be disguising it with stuff carefully selected from the piles of old rubbish lying around, leaning lengths of charred timber against one side, and scattering around a few broken pots, a rickety old ladder, and a two-legged stool. The real find, a dead dog, had been laid carefully across the threshold, despite the hygiene-based protests of Dr. Stone. "We won't move until just before dusk," I said. "Easier for everyone. They're not going to start carousing at 4:30 in the afternoon, and everyone agrees they were all well and truly pissed when they set fire to the place. Is everyone clear on where and when they should be?" They were, of course, but it never does any harm to remind people occasionally. My team were to shadow Alexander, getting as much footage of him as they could. There are very few images of Alexander, and no one knows for sure what he looked like, so anything we could get would be worth its weight in gold to Thirsk. The other team was to ignore everything going on around them. Drunken soldiers, wild carousing, panicking people, leaping flames, stampedes, falling buildings, the little things, as Bashford had said, and get themselves to the treasury to wait and see. I'd given them the freedom to make their own decisions and act as they saw fit until Markham gave the word to evacuate. I'd spoken sternly about not taking unnecessary risks, but to historians, there's no such thing. The sun was a red ball of fire, sinking slowly into the dusty horizon. Street life continued at full pace. I'd wondered if there would be a curfew, but apparently not. If anything, there seemed to be even more people on the streets than when we arrived. Dark shadows crept across the landscape. There's very little twilight in these latitudes. And now it was time to go. I spared a moment to wonder how things were going at St. Mary's, and then put it firmly out of my mind. Everyone had a job to do and should focus only on that. Dr. Bairstow, Peterson and Captain Ellis were all far more capable than me. They would have everything well in hand there, and I should be getting on with things here. I felt my heart lift a little. A chance to see Alexander. We all wished each other luck and slipped out into the gathering dark. The air smelled of sweet perfumes, incense, spices, dust, hot people, and even hotter animal products. The ends of my stole flapped in the wind, and I took a moment to wind it more tightly around my face, covering my mouth against the all-pervasive dust. The sand underfoot was coarse and gravelly, and would, I knew from experience, easily and painfully work its way into all my nooks and crannies. Trust me, when you come back from this sort of assignment, there's half a desert in the bottom of your shower tray. There were no streets as such, just narrow, gritty paths meandering around groups of buildings. Goats and really rough-looking sheep stood or lay silently in makeshift pens. Skinny stray dogs slunk past looking for somewhere to sleep, and even skinnier cats were waking up and setting off to see what the night might bring. With the sun gone, faint stars began to appear. The sky above me was a deep, rich purple, shading to a glowing lavender on the horizon. I opened my comm and called up Bashford. "All set? Ready when you are. Good luck, everyone." We had no difficulty getting into the palace complex. There was a constant procession of people traipsing up and down the great staircase and in and out of the Gate of All Nations. We needn't have worried about blending in either. This was a very cosmopolitan city. There were all sorts here, and all nationalities. Soldiers, traders, minor palace officials, and a massive number of slaves. Everyone was heading in the same direction, too. Under the Persian kings, Medes and Persians had taken a shorter, more privileged processional route to the great king, while lesser and conquered peoples went the long way around. Now everyone just piled in. There was some muttering and jostling, but everyone had an eye on the ever-present soldiers and behaved themselves. We joined the crowd pushing their way up the ceremonial staircase with its reliefs of conquered peoples bringing tribute. In fact, tribute-bringing and homage-paying were recurring themes throughout all the public buildings, presumably in case anyone forgot why they were there. I recorded what I could. Clerk navigated us through the crowds, and Markham watched our backs. Reaching the top, we passed through the massively impressive Gate of All Nations, past a couple of giant bulls I thought would look rather nifty outside the boss's office, through the unfinished gate, and into the throne hall courtyard where, despite all our careful training, we stopped and gawped like tourists. Yes, I know, but it was impossible not to be distracted by the magnificence around us. The entire complex was mind-boggling, gaudy and tasteless and opulent and over-decorated.